Good morning. Welcome into the 9 to 10 show. This is American DA Live for this Friday, the 27th day of September. Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson is with us. Good morning, Ray.
Good morning, Jack.
This one, the murder and case that we're going to talk about this morning, I know has been featured on one of the TV crime shows and maybe on more than one. I know it was also a book, and I'm sure our guests will be able to tell us which ones, but it's really creepy. Tell us, first of all, who our guest is, who's not creepy, and a little bit about the case.
Well, he may be creepy. I mean, this morning I tried to call, and I called him at his office, and he came on and said, Scott Patterson isn't in today, and I thought, oh, great.
So, Scott?
Hello.
Yeah, thanks, man. You had us all, we're breathing again.
Well, you got, you know, Ray Larson and I have a very contemptuous relationship.
Yeah.
That goes way back. I know he's a Kentucky Wildcat. I'm a North Carolina Tar Heel, so we've had many acrimonious times together.
I see.
That means feisty.
Oh, it does. Okay.
Yeah. It's very interesting. This is Scott's the state's attorney in Talbot County, Maryland, which is Easton, Maryland, and he's been a prosecutor for many years. Many more years than he's been the elected official.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a fascinating case, this murder case. And before Scott would come on the program, he said, you got to read about it before I'll talk to you about it. And so he sent me this 77-page opinion.
Wow.
Written by one of the great writers, Judge Moylan in Maryland.
So you did what you always do. You gave it to Chase Barnett to read for you.
Well, Chase read it. I read it.
Uh-huh.
And it really is a fascinating case. And Scott, first of all, thanks for being on.
Well, Ray, it's my pleasure. I know that the job that you do for Fayette County and the city of Lexington, and you're very passionate about being a prosecutor, and I admire your approach to it. I admire your website, which I went on once I saw that you were planning on doing this to take a look at, and it's a pleasure to be on your show.
Which is a 77-page website, too, by the way.
No, it's far more than that.
Far more than that, yeah. Sorry.
Well, Scott, first tell us a little bit about Talbot County. Tell me about your jurisdiction.
I'd be happy to, Ray. Talbot County, it's Talbot, by the way.
Talbot, that's right. Well, you know, my wife shops at Talbot's, yeah.
You know, as you're well aware, but the two or three of your regular listeners who are listening to the show may not be.
Each state, not all
states designate their attorneys, their prosecutors by the same name. You're a Commonwealth's attorney. I'm a state's attorney. Some places are district attorneys. Some places they're, you know, attorney generals. But we have in Maryland 24 political subdivisions, 23 counties in the city of Baltimore that constitute the state of Maryland. And if you have a picture of Maryland in your mind, well, for you, Ray, you may need a map, but the main geographic feature of the state of Maryland is the Chesapeake Bay, which is a very large body of water. The bay separates two-thirds of the state from the other third, the one-third being the eastern shore of Maryland. And Talbot County is in the geographic center of the eastern shore of Maryland, about halfway between the bay where Annapolis is located and the Atlantic Ocean. It's a smaller county, much smaller than your jurisdiction. We have maybe a little under 40,000 residents in the county. Easton is the primary city. We have other very picturesque destination vacation spots for people, the town of Oxford, the town of St. Michael's, which are both located on the water because we have more miles of waterfront than any other county in the state of Maryland. So it's a lovely place to be, and they call this the whole Eastern Shore the land of pleasant living, and I think we embody that very well.
Well, now that we've gotten the Chamber of Commerce out of the way.
I know where I'm vacationing next year.
That's right. Good job. So tell us, you and I were at a National District Attorneys Association Board of Directors meeting, and I asked you if you had any interesting cases that you would be willing to talk about on the radio show here. And you mentioned this, and I thought, man, this is really fascinating. I've been trying to get Scott to come on for a while, but he's had various things that he could, that just prevented him from being on. But now we're, I think, pretty fortunate to have him. And this is Kimberly Michelle Rico. Tell us a little bit about what is all this. Well, tell us about this case.
Well, let me do a little backfill for you. Once again, when I went on to your website to, because it was suggested that this was going to be this today's show and this case was going to be talked about, I went on and found a glaring error.
Okay.
Your website said that I prosecuted the case. I did not, and I'm going to tell you why. Back when this happened, back in the it was 1988 or so, I believe, in the mid-80s, dinner theater murder mysteries were kind of in vogue. A lot of them were happening in a lot of places. And in Easton having a lot of cultural venues and outlets for people who were interested in the arts, there was a director and a writer of such shows that lived here and was putting on dinner theater murder mysteries that she was original works that she was doing. And there came a time through one association or another that she enlisted me to be in her cast. And I had a regular recurring role in these theaters for a number of years. And after a while, I was kind of too busy and I just kind of got tired of it. And so I told her I was going to leave her cast, but she wanted somebody else who was associated with prosecution because they were murder mysteries to come in to help and you know, give information and help with technical stuff. And so a member of my staff, one of my senior assistants, said he'd like to do it. So he took my place. And that was an individual whose name you probably read in the opinion, Ray, but don't stand out to you, an individual by the name of Henry Dove. So Henry took my place and was in a number of these shows. And when this case occurred, he was in the cast of the murder mystery at which this murder took place. And I'll jump ahead for a minute, and then we'll get back to your main question, I guess. I've kind of forgotten what it was. But at any rate, during the course, we charged – let me start over again. When the murder occurred – after an exhaustive investigation by the state police, Maryland State Police, we charged, elected to charge Kimberly Rico with the death of her husband. And the case was charged and was set into motion for trial. And she obtained to represent her two of the more prominent defense lawyers in the state of Maryland who came in and started doing their own exhaustive research and investigation of the case, as any good defense lawyer will do. And they determined that my prosecutor, Henry Dove, who was a cast member, sat at the table during the dinner part of the murder mystery dinner with the defendant and the deceased. And when they found that out, they made a motion to the court to have my office recused because they were going to call him as a witness. And as Ray, as you're aware, you know, that puts you in a, you know, when you have one of your attorneys being a witness in a trial, that puts you in a ticklish position. So the court recused our office, said your office can't prosecute it. We're going to appoint a special prosecutor. At that time, this would have been, once again, in 1989, I guess, when the prosecution took place. At that time, we had just had election cycle in Maryland, and a very renowned state's attorney from another county, who was an excellent trial attorney but not so great a politician, lost his election and was in between positions. And so the court appointed him, who also happens to be a good friend of mine, to as a special prosecutor for this case. That individual, whose name is Bob Dean, subsequently went into another prosecutor's office after this case, prosecuted murders for a while, and then he was signed on to become a prosecutor in Kosovo to prosecute war crimes, which he did for a number of years. And he's now working for the UN, going around the world to helping other countries set up their judicial systems. The last time I saw him was this summer. He had a number of judges from Jordan in the United States who are studying the United States system. And does that music mean I'm going too long?
Yeah, we're going to take a break. Just hold that thought. If you have a question or comment along the way here, 253-5959, touch star 590 from AT&T. Toll free from anywhere, 1-877-777-0590. Email jackpatty at wvlkam.com. 20 minutes after 9, and that is time to get the highest price for your scrap gold at the Castle. Discounters of diamonds and fine jewelry, and our forecast is brought to you by Landscaper's Corner at 1305 Old Frankfort Pike. Landscaper's Corner has Triple Crown Elite grass seed, the seed everybody's talking about. Call 225-9433. Mostly sunny, up to 80 today. Mostly clear tonight, low in the mid-50s. On Saturday, mostly sunny with a high in the low 80s. On Sunday, partly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms late in the day and a high in the mid to upper 70s. Checking the radar, no precipitation. We have sunny skies out there. It is 58 at your official weather station, News Talk 590 WVLK. And Jan Miller this morning has been attempting through various and sundry ways to send me some photos of one of the latest projects that Nature's Expressions has done. And I got one picture, but I didn't get the others. And anyway, through lots of work on her part this morning, she was able to finally send this to me. It's a project that involved an addition of a beautiful screen room on the back of this home here. I guess it was in Lexington, wherever, somewhere in central Kentucky, that leads out now to this beautiful bubbler. And bubbler is a term that they used to describe what I guess most people might refer to as a fountain, but it's a gorgeous, looks like a millstone, big, I mean, huge flat-top rock that has the water coming out from the middle of that rock and flowing out to the top and then into this bed. And it's absolutely beautiful, and it's very indicative of the kind of work that Nature's Expressions do. And we want you to know that they do work all winter. So if you have something planned, something in your mind that you would like to have for next spring, it is definitely time to give them a call at 885-0015. They'll come out and talk to you about that, give you some great suggestions. 885-0015. I also encourage you to check their...
An extremely powerful weight loss supplement is being given out to listeners in this area on a strict first-come, first-served basis. You must be between the ages of 25 and 65 and need to lose at least 30 pounds. Please call now only if you qualify. 1-800-906-6961. This product is proven and can cause extreme weight loss, so supplies are limited. It's called Final Trim. Take two capsules just once a day as directed, and you can experience maximum weight loss, pounds in days. It uses natural ingredients, making it healthy and safe. If your weight loss with Final Trim is too dramatic, please decrease use and only take one capsule a day. Call now and you will be given a full-size supply of Final Trim to use absolutely risk-free. Repeat, Final Trim is being given out to listeners on a strict first-come, first-served basis. Supplies are limited. Call 1-800-906-6961. 1-800-906-6961. That toll-free number again is 1-800-906-6961.
If you own a business, you know incorporating can be a smart way to protect yourself and your assets. So the question is, why haven't you incorporated your business yet?
My business? It's too small.
Wrong. No matter how small your business, you run the risk of losing all your personal assets, your car, your home, even your entire life savings if you're not incorporated.
Incorporating is very complicated.
Actually, incorporating is easy and fast. You can do it in just 10 minutes. Call now for your free guide from LLC.com. 1-800-940-7237.
I need a lawyer to incorporate. That's really expensive.
You don't need a lawyer, and we don't offer legal or financial advice. LLC.com is a service company whose only mission is helping people like you incorporate safely, easily, and quickly. Find out how simple it is to protect your family and personal assets by incorporating. Call now for your free guide. 1-800-940-7237. 1-800-940-7237. That's 1-800-940-7237.
If you're overwhelmed by debt and thinking about going to a credit counseling company for help, think again. Because the majority of those companies actually work for the credit card companies. And they make the credit card companies a lot of money. From people just like you. But there's another way out of debt, and it's not bankruptcy. A way to reduce your debts and save you thousands of dollars. Even better, you can find out how for free by calling 1-800-509-3950. At Freedom Debt Relief, we're not a credit counseling organization. We're not a debt consolidation company. We offer a unique alternative to save you the most money possible to resolve your debt in the shortest amount of time. If you're thinking about a credit counselor, ask yourself this. Are they working for you or the credit card companies? Reduce your debts and save thousands of dollars by learning the secrets to settling your debt. For free information, call 1-800-509-3950. That's 1-800-509-3950. 1-800-509-3950.
Special. Don't get overcharged from the high price dealers. Come to Covey's Auto today. Covey's Auto. Call 281-CARS.
Listen to News Talk 590 WVLK live anywhere, anytime at WVLKAM.com.
And we are back. Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson with us in the studio and State's Attorney Scott Patterson of Easton, Maryland is on the phone. We're talking about a murder that occurred back in 88, February 14th, I believe. Go ahead, Ray.
Okay, Scott. So Bob Dean was the prosecutor, and now he's teaching other countries about our judicial system, right, and that sort of thing.
Yeah, so I digress, and I'm sorry about going off on a limb there. So let's talk about this case, Ray.
Okay, so tell us about it.
Well, the case, as I indicated, it was there was a murder mystery dinner theater that was being put on at one of the resorts in the county on Valentine's, and leading up to that, there was a woman and her husband from the western shore of Maryland who had been having marital difficulties, as often happens, I guess, in today's society. And they had, after, I don't know how long, 8 or 9 years of marriage and with one child, gotten to the point where Mrs. Rico was very much wanting to be out of the marriage. And as the case developed and as the evidence showed at the trial, she wanted out of the marriage so badly that at one point she even talked to a coworker about paying to have her husband killed, which wasn't really taken seriously by that coworker.
Why was divorce not an option?
Well, divorce was an option, but she didn't want to have to worry about her husband gaining custody of their child. She was worried about that. She was having an affair with a Marine who was stationed at the Pentagon. Probably it should have been the option. I mean, that divorce is an acceptable way of terminating marriages that don't work. But she just maybe was evil enough that she discarded that idea.
Now, she was a nurse, is that right?
She was a nurse's assistant, or physician's assistant.
I see.
I don't know that she was an actually trained nurse. I don't recall that, Ray. But she was a in the medical profession in some way. And the coworker was in the medical profession, and he even made a comment to her at one point when she had approached him and said, for a certain amount of money, have him killed, he discarded that idea and said, no, I'm not going to do it. He said, look, you work in operating rooms all the time. Why don't you just put him to sleep? Kind of an off-the-cuff comment, some long period of time before it actually happened, that may have planted the seed in her mind as far as a way to kill her husband and not get caught.
Just as a point in reference right here real quick, a physician's assistant in today's world is a highly trained person just below a doctor, but I don't think she was that.
She may not have been. She may have been a tech. I don't know exactly what she was. But she was used to being in an operating room. She was used to being in a hospital. She had access to drug cabinets. She had access to medications. And she had access to what was ultimately used as the drug to, as the court, medical examiner referred to, poison the deceased. But it really wasn't a poison in the way that we think of a poison ordinarily. It's a different kind of drug, which we can get into in a moment. But anyway, she developed this plan. She also talked about her plan to various people, to friends, about things that she was, you know, saying, not necessarily that I'm going to kill him, but I wish he were dead. I want him to be dead. At one point, and after she had been drinking, even indicated how she might do it if she ever wanted to do it, which turned out to be the way she did it.
Well, the one of the fascinating things that I learned reading this thing is about this drug that I want to talk about.
Okay.
Let's take a break and let's talk about that when we come back. If you have a question or comment, 253-5959, touch star 590 from AT&T, toll free from anywhere, 1-877-777-0590, or email jackpatty@wvlkam.com. And DA Live, Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson is with us in the studio, and State's Attorney from Eastern Maryland, Scott Patterson, is on the line. And Ray?
So, Scott, when you were talking to me at the National District Attorneys Association board meeting, the thing that fascinated me the most was this drug that I can't pronounce it, but...
Cicacoline.
Well, tell us about it and how did she use it and how did this all occur?
Ray, this is a drug that medical professionals use. EMTs even use it on ambulances when they need it. It's a drug that will instantly, almost instantly, if you give it to them in a vein, it's instant. If you give it to them in a muscle, it takes maybe 3 to 5 seconds. Paralyzes every muscle in the body. And the reason that medical professionals use this drug is if they have to establish an airway to intubate someone, get a tube in their mouth through their larynx and down into their lung area so they can breathe. You can't do it if the muscles are going to reject it, and so it will inject someone with this, establish an airway so that a person can breathe. It is a drug that once it is put into the body. It is assimilated by the body very quickly. It is assimilated, but it's also metabolized, and it goes away pretty quickly. On its own, it will leave. But in the meantime, if you haven't established an airway, you've got no ability for your lungs to breathe in and out. Your heart stops beating. Everything stops. Every muscle is paralyzed. It is a drug that is very similar to the type of drug that certain ethnic South American Indians use on tips of blow darts and so forth, called curare, that they will use to when they're hunting to drop an animal. It's I guess derived maybe from the same plant, but that's the drug, and it's easy. It's not even controlled like narcotics are. It's easy to get a hold of by people who are in a position where they can get a hold of it, such as the defendant in this case.
So what was her plan, and how did she carry it out?
Well, her plan that she had even told someone about beforehand was that she was going to inject this into her husband in their home, and then she thought that he'd still be breathing enough so that when she set then the house on fire, he'd die from smoke inhalation or something like that, and that would... be the cause of death. That person said, you know, you're crazy. You can't set your house on fire. You got neighbors. It could spread to other houses. That's just nuts. And so she discarded that idea.
Who was this friend that she told that to?
Pardon me?
Who was the friend that she told that to?
A longtime friend. And she had been She was very distraught one night, and she had been drinking, and she called the friend over in the middle of the night, really upset about one thing or another, while her husband was even asleep in the house, and disclosed this to this friend, which came out at the trial. The friend testified as to, and other people who she'd made different comments to about wanting her husband dead testified at the trial, but that was her plan. And so when this murder mystery dinner theater took place, her husband had, through a friend, arranged to take the defendant to this as kind of a romantic getaway, because he knew they were having trouble and he'd been in counseling and he wanted to get a fresh start and make the marriage work. And so she played along with it and went along. And after the dinner and the murder mystery, they went back to the suite that had been provided to them. She injected him with the drug, set the room on fire, left for a while, came back, reported to the management that the house is on, that the room is on fire. They went in and it wasn't fully consumed, and they came in and pulled the deceased from the room, who was quite dead at the time and partially burned. The investigation began from there.
Well, so what, because you said earlier that the drug metabolizes or is out of his system in a hurry. How did the medical examiner, how were they able to determine the cause of death?
Well, Ray, that's a very good question, and you, as the experienced prosecutor that you are, and having dealt with medical examiners, know that the way medical examiners work is what's called forensics. A medical examiner who works with the police and investigation of crimes and homicides is called a forensic medical examiner, which means that they don't look just at the body; they look at all the circumstances surrounding how the body came to be. And one of the things, the first things that medical examiners have to do whenever they conduct an autopsy is they have to eliminate the other causes of death. They eliminate that it was a heart attack. They eliminate that he had a stroke. They eliminate that he died from cancer. They eliminate that he fell from a rooftop. They eliminate all the other causes of death, either for medical or accidental reasons. And then once they get to the point where they've eliminated everything else, they start looking at what did cause it. And in this particular instance, from the forensic standpoint, they had the deputy medical examiner, David Fowler, who is now the chief medical examiner for the state of Maryland, had the forensics investigation of the police to rely upon and knew about the succinylcholine that she had access to, about the drug, and formulated that is what she had used, because there was absolutely no other indication of any reason why he died other than that. I would note that her plan failed utterly, because he was quite dead at the time she started the fire, and there was no evidence in the body whatsoever of any carbon monoxide in his system. There was no soot or smoke inhalation by him, because he was not breathing. So none of the effects of the fire got into his system that would have caused the death, and that was another elimination.
Well, in addition to that, you had the conversation she had with her friend.
Absolutely, yeah. Which is part of the forensics. These things don't happen in a vacuum, and so that helped the medical examiner formulate his opinion. And as Judge Moylan noted, you read the opinion. He quoted a lot of works, written works, a lot of Shakespeare and so forth. And one of the quotes that he put into his opinion was from Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes series, and as I recall, I don't have it in front of me, but it goes something like this, and that is, once you have eliminated the impossible, then what you are left with is the probable.
Hmm. Interesting. Why don't we take this opportunity to take a break? 253-5959, touch star. It's a really, as I said at the beginning of the program, this is a fascinating and at the same time really creepy way this woman chose to kill her husband. And Dr. Ryan Stanton is our go-to guy when it comes to medical things. He is an ER doc and one of our regular guests on the show. Ryan, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Tell us a little more in a more clinical way, if you will, about this particular drug that this woman used to kill her husband and the effect that it has on the human body.
Well, succinylcholine is what we call a pyrolytic. So when there's only, it's a very controlled substance, and even in the hospitals, not all doctors use it. It's usually limited to anesthesia, emergency medicine, and then maybe some of the intensive care unit physicians. So it's very limited even in the hospital setting. And usually when we use it for airways, like you guys have been talking about, and usually we give two medicines. One is the sedation medicine, that's so they're not aware of what's going on. And the second, which is what succinylcholine is, which is a paralytic, which means it deactivates all the muscles in the body. So if you've seen the movie Alive or Awake or whatever it is, this is the medicine where they can't move, they can't breathe, but they're awake.
And they're aware of, without that sedative ahead of time, they're aware of what's going on, right?
Yeah. So they are perfectly aware of everything that's going on with them. So, a decade or two ago, they would, in some trauma, they'd give it to patients that were combative, and then they would actually talk to them, so they would be calm. Of course, now, ethically, we definitely don't do that anymore. But it's a medicine that will paralyze them, but they'll be awake. They just can't move or breathe on their own. So they're completely dependent upon somebody else. And so that's why it's so limited in the emergency setting, is because once you give them this medicine, if you can't get an airway in them, they will die.
Wow. And that makes this even more heinous, because this guy knew, I guess, I'm getting ready to die here, and was aware of it for some length of time before, I guess, he passed out. Obviously, he passed out before the fire because there wasn't any smoke in his lungs.
Yeah, well, and there wouldn't be any smoke in his lungs because they don't breathe on their own, so there wouldn't be any smoke in their lungs.
Whether he died before or after, yeah, okay.
And that's what it does, is it completely incapacitated the lungs. So even if he was alive in the fire, he wouldn't have smoke in his lungs because there wouldn't be no respiratory effort.
Okay.
Now, what it does mean is that there was no, that he died before the medicine wore off. Because in the clinical setting, if we give it in the IV, it wears off in about 5 minutes.
Okay.
So it's just very rapid on and off, and that's why we like it, because it's very fast acting, but it also comes off very quickly.
Ryan, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah.
Let's go to the phones. This is Jerry. Good morning, Jerry.
Yeah, good morning, Ray, and your guest there. Ray, I don't know. I just wonder how many cases there have been discovered like this. I heard of a case, and you probably have too, where a medical technician gave this kind of drug or a similar drug to a woman that was having these, what do you call the really bad headaches that people get?
Migraines.
Yeah. She was suffering from migraines, and he visited her apartment or home and gave her a shot like this. And he was kind of mad at her because she rejected his romantic advances. Anyway, she got the drug, and then I think they actually exhumed the body later on after she died, and they found in her garbage, they found a bag and full of needles and things like that, and evidence of this, or otherwise they may not have solved the case. And they actually had him brought back from, he escaped to Ireland where he was originally from, and they brought him back and they convicted him. I just wonder how often this happens, these kind of cases. Do you have any idea?
I can tell you it's never happened that we've, not, no
You've
case
never had one
we've,
here?
We've handled.
Interesting.
Yeah.
All right, from here we've got 6 minutes, so let's get through the trial.
Okay. Scott?
Yes, sir.
So tell us, how long did this trial last?
This trial lasted the better part of a week, as I recall, because in addition to the extensive testimony concerning the actual death, she was also charged with arson of the room. And there was a lot of investigation concerning that, and the fire marshal testified as to all the things that could not have caused the fire, and she had attempted to blame this on smoking, that the defendant caught the room on fire by smoking, whereas everyone had known him for his entire life, said he was a non-smoker. He was never observed smoking by anybody, and they found a a partially open box of cigars in the room, one burnt one, and they did extensive tests to show that cigar could not have started the fire, and they found that she had, in fact, through their extensive investigation, purchased those cigars herself at a store on the Western Shore, in advance of coming into this dinner theater. So it was a long trial because they were really trying two crimes: the murder itself, plus the arson of the room that was being used to cover up the murder.
Did she take the stand?
She did not.
Let's talk a little bit about whether or not the decision that defendants make along with their attorneys. They make those decisions about whether or not to testify in a case. And why do you think she didn't testify?
Well, she probably didn't testify because she, once again, had two of the best defense counsel in the state advising her. But there was no way she could have testified and dealt with having to answer questions about all the testimony given by people she had made statements to and the various things that she had done prior to this. She would not have been able to answer those. She just had nothing she could have done on the stand. Plus the fact when she started making statements to the police after the offense, her statements were so inconsistent, had so many holes in them, she would have had to create yet a third or fourth story, and she would have just not been able to pull that off. There's no way she could have testified based on the evidence that the police had generated.
Scott, do you have the death penalty in Maryland?
No.
Okay. So that wasn't on the table?
No.
Let
me go back. The death penalty in Maryland has changed, has been eliminated, but for all intents and purposes. But back then, I believe it did exist, but it was not a death eligible.
Yeah, what I was wondering. Okay.
It was not death eligible. Okay. It didn't have the prerequisite that would have made her eligible for it. So yes and no, we don't effectively have it now, but back then it wasn't a death eligible.
Wouldn't have made any difference.
Okay. Here's the question. In Kentucky, if a murder occurs in the course of an arson, then that becomes an aggravating circumstance.
But this wasn't. This was the arson was used to cover up already occurred.
Isn't that interesting?
So it wouldn't have applied
here.
It would not have applied.
So what happened?
Well, what happened was she was convicted. She got a life sentence on the murder. She got a consecutive 30-year sentence for the arson, and she filed all the standard post-trial motions: a motion for new trial, motion for reconsideration of sentence, post-conviction petitions, appeals to the Court of Special Appeals, which is our intermediate appellate court, a petition for cert to the Court of Appeals, I believe, which was denied, and she is in prison.
What does life plus 30 mean in Maryland? It means about a day and a half in Kentucky.
Well, no, in Maryland, as I understand it, when you get a consecutive sentence, you're supposed to do the first sentence before you get to the second one to get paroled. So I think that the consecutive part for her means a life sentence.
Well, at least it sends a message to a parole board that we mean what we say from the jury.
Right.
Yeah, that's that.
She could potentially be paroled, but probably won't be. Is that what you're suggesting?
I'm saying potentially she could be a very long time from now.
Well, she's earned it. This is really a sinister case, and
there was a book written about it. Do you know which TV show did the show on it?
I do not. They came in. They did some interviews with my prosecutor who had been on the cast and at her table. But other than that, I can't tell you which, once again, this was a long time ago.
Right. I remember seeing it a long time ago on TV.
I just don't remember the show and didn't read the book. It was interesting. I mean, part of her claim was that he was drunk, had been drinking heavily, at the time of this murder, and that he passed out smoking or whatever and caused it, whereas my prosecutor, who was at the table, said he had one beer. The medical examiner's report showed a 0.00 blood alcohol content. I mean, so, you know, she just, you know, made up a lie that she got caught in, once again, by forensics.
Scott, thank you so much for being with us. Interesting, fascinating story.
Well, it has been my pleasure. When my good friend Ray Larson, your Commonwealth attorney, asked me to do this, I couldn't say no to him. I've got the utmost respect for Ray and the job that he does for the citizens of your jurisdiction.
As do we. Thank you. Stand by. We have an update from ABC coming up next. If you're listening to WVLK AM, stay with us. Live with Lee is next. If you're listening to 101.5 FM,